everyone. Welcome to Stutter Talk. Continuing the opening with voluntary stuttering. This is episode 270 for April 3rd, 2011. Stutter Talk, your answer to the fluency bigots. Is that a good tagline there, Bob? What do you think? I'm your host, Peter Reitzes, here with Robert the Expert Queasel, known to his friends just as Dr. Queasel, not known to his friends as Bob, and Karen True Life Herring. Is that...
Oh my goodness, you've got to be kidding.
Is that okay, or is that not okay? I don't know, I'm just having a little...
I can't believe that's the tagline that I got.
Well, it can be modified or changed.
Karen, the true life, ridiculous.
We could shape that in future episodes. Okay, Bob Queasel is a professor of communication sciences and disorders at Western Illinois University, a person who stutters, a board-recognized fluency specialist, and a fellow of the American Speech Language Hearing Association. Karen Herring is a B-team co-host, a person who stutters, and a graduate student at Purdue University. Karen's going to graduate in August 2011 with her master's in speech language pathology, and Karen is the chapter leader and founder of the Lafayette, Indiana National Stuttering Association chapter. I'm your host, Peter Reitzes. I'm a person who stutters and a speech language pathologist in Brooklyn. You guys ready to go?
Yeah.
Sure.
Am I forgiven, Karen?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make a couple announcements here at the top of the show. I think Stutter Talk listeners may be interested to know that in 1 year, in the past year, Stutter Talk has been downloaded more than 400,000 times, approaching 500,000 times. I think that's pretty awesome for a stuttering podcast to reach those numbers. So thanks to everyone for getting the word out. I want to mention that Stutter Talk has officially put together a advisory council. Karen, I think you might be the youngest member of the advisory council. Do you think that's right?
Woohoo!
Bob, you are not the youngest member.
I'm the oldest.
Bob, you might be the most called upon member of the advisory council, but you are not the youngest. Yes, and what the advisory council is, there's many people on it. I'm not going to name anybody because I don't want to leave anybody out, but a lot of preparation and research and thought goes into every Stutter Talk episode, and I'm continually calling and emailing people like Bob and Karen with questions. So I wanted the listeners to be able to go to stuttertalk.com, click on the advisory council, and to see some of the people who really give their time to help me put together some research, to help me think through and prep some shows. So thanks to the advisory council. And one more piece of news is that former co-host and co-founder of Stutter Talk, Eric Jackson, has decided to move on to new endeavors. Eric is an outstanding role model for people who stutter and was a very thoughtful and dynamic and inspirational co-host. Eric will be missed, and Stutter Talk wishes him the very, very best.
I will miss Eric, certainly. I think I did more live shows with Eric than I've done with you, Peter, because he was at the St. Rose Fluency Weekend about a year ago, actually, when I was the keynote speaker. So that's when I first met Eric face to face, and he and I did maybe two or three shows there at St. Rose, and I certainly did have a very good time with Eric there, and I think you're right that he really is an excellent role model for people who stutter, and I think that he certainly will be missed. So
yeah, it's really special to do those live shows in person with people. You get to meet them. I mean, I've met you many times over the years, but recording with you at the National Stuttering Association was very special. So I really want to personally thank Eric for all that he did for Stutter Talk and will continue to do for the stuttering community.
I just want to say that I mean, I've known Eric for a few years now, and he's been such a huge role model for me over the past few years, and he's become a great friend. And I really feel like I couldn't have made the transition into accepting my stuttering and understanding my speech without him.
Mm. Well, that is great to hear. He's touched many, many people, and I'm sure will continue to do so. Thank you both for sharing those thoughts. Stutter Talk can be contacted at 206-666-5340, stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com. I also just want to briefly mention that when you go to stuttertalk.com, we're updating a lot of stuttering events in the stuttering community. So if you look in the left-hand sidebar, we have a bunch of events listed for April, and then we have some events, not some, we have a lot of the major events that are going on throughout the year. So be sure to check out that information at stuttertalk.com. Are you guys ready for some topics?
Yeah, sounds good.
Oh, sure. Great. So last week on the show, it was really a tremendous honor and pleasure to have Dorvin Breitenfeldt on, who was the founder or the creator of the Successful Stuttering Management Program, a program that really personally meant a lot to me and really inspired me. And I wish I would have said this to Dorv on air. He is truly fearless in the face of stuttering. And being around somebody like that and just seeing them stutter so openly without fear and just going up to anybody and talking to them about stuttering, it's really inspirational. There's one point that I really wanted to talk to him about, and I forgot all about it until I got an email from a great friend of the show, Ari from Israel. And Ari brought up the point that sometimes when Dorv was initiating a sound or working through it, he changed the sound a little bit. So instead of saying David, it sounds like Dorv was saying Zavid. So one of the handling techniques, the speech tools that's a part of the successful stuttering management program, is changing a stop sound to a continuant sound. And before we sort of bat that around, Bob, could you explain to the listeners what a stop sound is and what a continuant sound is?
Yeah, I think the terms are pretty, unlike many terms in speech language, pathology, those two terms are relatively self-explanatory. But again, a stop consonant is where you actually stop the air, if you will, at some point, and then kind of let that air go. So it's kind of a popping sound. So for example, a sound where you put your lips together and you say like a P sound or a B sound, where you, in both those cases you would put your lips together and just for a fraction of a second you build up a little bit of pressure and let that pressure go, and it kind of pops out. And also the D and the T and the K and the G sounds. So the T, D, K, G sounds are what are called stop consonants. A continuant sound, as the name suggests, is a sound that you can actually keep going. So some examples of continuous sounds would be vowels, where I can say E and I can hold that sound out. A sound like a sound is a continuous sound. So any sound that you're able to prolong, and it doesn't lose that the sound quality, if you will, would be a continuous sound.
So like saying Zavid for David or baby for baby, those are two good examples, right?
Right. And see, in that case, you know, the reason that a stop cannot be really made into a continuant is because it changes the nature of that sound. In other words, you really can't prolong a stop sound and have it maintain its stop quality.
Okay.
You know, when you start to prolong it, makes it sound different. So if you do say, Zavid, then it doesn't sound like a duh, like David. It sounds more like kind of a Z sound or something like that. So it sort of changes the way that the sound sounds, if that makes sense.
Oh, sure, it makes total sense. And I'll just read briefly from the Successful Stuttering Management Program's manual, where they write, these sounds that stop plosive consonants, these sounds give stutterers particular difficulty because the stutterer tends to get stuck in the place he is stopping the air or voice flow. To solve this problem, we can change the stop plosive to a continuant sound. This is done by using a light contact of the articulators. Karen, take it where you will. What do you make of all this?
Well, I never really took much thought about all this, and I was actually teaching my friends how to do this because they were working with some clients who stutter, and they had brought it up to me that they couldn't even understand what words I was trying to say because I was changing the sounds.
Mm.
And it didn't ever occur to me that that sort of poses a problem, and that I really do change the sounds when it's going from a stop consonant to a continuant sound. And they really brought that up to me like a week or so ago. So this topic is still kind of fresh in my mind, and I'm still trying to work through it myself, how I feel about it.
Wow, it's good timing then for this topic. Were you taught to change a stop plosive to a continuant sound, or was that something you just started doing on your own?
I think I was taught. I didn't go to the Successful Stuttering Management Program, or I didn't learn from their manual, but I almost feel like when I was taught like a repertory set or just like light context in general, I was sort of taught, rather than doing the hard stop, to just sort of ease into that stop by letting some air out, which sort of sounds like a continuous sound.
Sure. Bob, before I get you to weigh in on your opinion on all this, can you put it into context? This is the only program I know that actually, this is the only stuttering modification program I know that actually suggests changing a sound so that it's easier to say. Do you know if it's more widespread than just the Successful Stuttering Management Program?
I think that this is the kind of a technique that's often used. I don't know if it's actually expressed in the way that it is in the SSMP manual.
Okay.
In the sense that you actually say, you know, turn a stop consonant into a continuous sound. But I think that the whole notion of trying to reduce the amount of effort that you're using when you speak. So if you are coming to a, you know, and I'm going to try to sort of imitate what you might do here. You know, you're coming to a word that's a difficult word to say, so you're stuck on that duh sound. And in some cases, people who stutter, you know, just get stuck. I mean, they just block on that sound. So the issue is you want to do something to try to release some of that tension and make the sound easier, keep speech moving. And so oftentimes when in a stop you're trying to let go of some of that tension, you'll do something like difficult. And so it's not exactly, you know, in an intentional way turning the stop into a continuous sound, but the way to get that stop going is often to kind of ease up a bit, and so what ends up coming out is something like, that's a difficult word to say.
Mm.
So it still sounds different. It still sounds different.
Right.
But it's that notion there of the goal is to get yourself unstuck, if you will. And so oftentimes, again, the nature of speech is such that, you know, if you do anything with a stop consonant besides let it explode, then the sound that's going to come out is not going to be truly a stop consonant.
So it sounds like you're saying that the SSMP manual is a little bit more explicit in how it teaches this, where the intent of stuttering modification may be to use a light contact to initiate a sound, and using that light contact may lead to a slight altercation of the sound. That's pretty much what you're saying?
Right.
Now, what do you make of this idea of saying to people who stutter, let's actually go into it intending to change a stop plosive to a continuant sound? And it is like when you go through the SSMP, it is pretty overt. You hear people, clinicians and people who stutter saying baby for baby. It's definitely a clear, oh, that's a different letter. Do you think that is appropriate or the way to go, or what are your views on it?
I would say the thing that you're trying to do there is, you know, very much sort of in the spirit of Van Riper. What you're trying to do is you're trying to learn a different pattern of stuttering, if you will. Okay, and so the notion there is that is it better to be stuck saying baby? And again, I did that first.
Okay, good.
But is it better to be stuck, you know, trying to say the word baby and be building up a lot of pressure and, you know, and exerting a lot of effort? Or is it better to sort of learn that when you come to a sound like that, you can say the sound with less effort, and so you can say a word like baby and kind of ease into that word differently? And it's sort of like trying to break old patterns or break old habits, again, very much like Van Riper tried to get clients to do. And so I think it's simply trying to replace an old pattern with a new pattern. And again, in this case, it's actually telling the client in a very specific way, this is a way that you can approach those sounds, and you'll be able to say them in a way that will require less effort than perhaps you've been using before. Mm.
This might be a stretch, but isn't changing all your stops to continuance sort of like avoiding?
Yeah, I don't think that's a stretch at all. I think that's an awesome point, and I felt like that when I was when I first saw this tool in action. I thought, oh, this could be avoidance. This could lead to secondaries. We're getting further away from where we want to be. So,
because yeah. I have to say, I feel like I stutter on continuous sounds too. It's not like I only stutter on stop.
Yeah, great point. That's why, like, I sort of, you know, I'm really glad we're talking about all this, because in my mind, I'm putting it all together. And what I like about what the SSMP manual is saying is the idea of using a light contact. So if you're getting stuck, don't push so hard. But I'm not thrilled about the idea of saying the intent should be to actually produce an altered or different sound. And I have to say,
Peter, the first time you said baby, I had no idea what word you were trying to say.
Well, and I did that on purpose because that was my experience and by the way, I think it's clear to everybody that I am a great admirer of the spirit of the SSMP and of the work that they do there. So this is just only one small aspect of the program, but that was my experience, was that people were saying words that had the wrong letter at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
So, Bob, I think you were going to say something?
Well, I guess the thing I would say is if we're going to talk about this as being a type of avoidance, I think it would be more like this. If you're talking along and you came to a hard word, or you were going to say toddler, you know, I think that's really what we're talking about when we talk about avoiding, is you have a word you want to say, and then you choose a different word. And I suppose in some ways, if you say, you know, baby instead of baby, I suppose you are saying a different word at some level. But I think, again, this is more learning a skill or a technique that lets you say the words that you want to say, as opposed to coming up to a word and saying, you know, this is a hard word for me to say, which is, I think, typically the nature of avoidance, which is word switching or not saying things, as opposed to learning techniques that make it possible to say words in a different way.
I just think that there could be sort of a chain reaction from that. Like, oh, I'm going to start replacing all of my hard stop sounds with continuous sounds, And then what happens when those become hard to say?
Right, sure, that's right. That's one of the risks that we often run in speech therapy. I was just talking to my graduate stuttering class this morning about what I refer to as artifacts of previous therapy. People learn these skills in therapy. The skills are designed or intended to do one thing, but then the client starts to use them in a way that's not the way that they were meant to be used. And yeah, so you have somebody who then, doing the baby or whatever it might be. Yeah, and so it's often very, very difficult when you're trying to teach any sort of a therapy technique because you don't know exactly how the client is going to interpret that technique, nor do you know how they're going to actually use that technique. And I think there's a risk that almost any technique could turn into a trick or a crutch or something like that if the client doesn't really understand why they're using it.
Well, we haven't solved this issue, but I dare say we got a lot of the important stuff on the table. I just want to remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitzis here with Bob Kwiesel and Karen Herring. Thank you guys so much for joining us today. I want to bring up another topic, and I should say here towards the beginning of the show, I should have said it at the top of the show, that we're going to cover a couple small topics now, and then in the second half of the show, we're going to devote that part of the show to graduate students who stutter. So for the second small topic, I get asked, and I'm sure you guys get asked too, very general questions about stuttering all the time. So it's usually something like, I have a third grader who stutters on my caseload. What do I do? And I got a variant of that this week from somebody I've known for years. And the person's, and of course, you know, they're trying to help their clients who stutter, and I appreciate that they're reaching out. And so I get the question, I have a third grader who stutters with social anxiety issues. What do I do? I think we called on Bob first the last time. So Karen, what do you do when somebody comes up to you? Because you're probably the student in your grad program who's the stuttering person, and I'm sure people come up to you. So what do you tell them when you get such general questions?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like you said, I think it's great that they're trying to seek help. I think for someone who doesn't know about stuttering, one of the worst things they can do is just sort of pretend that they know.
Right.
Actually, I'm student teaching right now, and I got asked to go to the high school for a day and basically see all the clients they have who stutter because the SLP didn't know what she was supposed to do. So I saw all the clients who stutter while she just, like, took notes on what she was supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Which was new for me. But, yeah. I don't know, especially when you don't know the kid or the adult or whoever they're asking for help with. I don't think there's any clean-cut rule of how to treat someone. I think it's really based on who the person is and where they are in their life and what they want and what they're willing to do.
Well, so it sounds like you're saying that before you prescribe a treatment, you have to actually know somebody. That's amazing.
For sure. But I also feel like some of the questions that I've been asked are very general things that they probably could learn from reading a book. Like, there's not, like, the ideas or the facts that I'm telling them, I didn't make up. I mean, I learned them from either talking to people or, like, straight out of a book.
Yeah.
It almost seems like they don't want to put that work in. They just want me to, like, do it for them.
I have gotten the same feeling in the past. Bob, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, if I were Karen and I were at Purdue, I would say ask Bill Murphy.
When I was student teaching, it wasn't at Purdue. It was out of town.
Okay, all right. So, but
very,
anyway.
Very, very true.
But anyway, I learned from Walt Manning that, you know, basically when you're asked that question, the response is, I don't know. I don't know what to do with your client, because I've never met this client. So I think that the point you're making, Peter, is the right one. That is that you have to know the client to be able to start talking about what you need to do with that client. And so I think Walt and I have had a number of conversations over the years about those questions people ask, where they raise their hand and say, you know, I've got this client and he's got a cleft palate and cerebral palsy and he stutters. What should I do? You know? And you're like, I don't know. I don't really know. And there was a time when I would feel bad, like, well, here I am giving this talk about stuttering, and I should have answers. But then you realize that when people give you these, I've got this kid who stutters, plus he's got, in your case, it was a third grader with a social anxiety disorder as well as stuttering.
Or
is that what you're
at least
talking about,
Peter? Yeah, social anxiety issues of some sort. Yeah,
issues. Okay,
which might and be so caused that, by this. Stuttering.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, maybe, and then so that's when you want to get in there and actually meet this child and talk to him or her and start to understand. Well, obviously, you know, which is cause, which is effect. What exactly is the role of these social anxiety issues? Is somebody simply perceiving the child as being socially anxious because of the speech problems? And there's all these factors that enter into that. So when you sit there and say, well, if it was me, I would teach the child to use slow speech or easy onsets. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, you can't do that without having a chance to meet the child or the client and have a chance to sit down and talk to them and get to know them at some level.
See, I'm really a polite person, but I'm wondering if I were to just, because I get asked this question all the time, if I were to just for a second just sort of play a game and say, oh, you should definitely have them work on breathing. Like give, like just something like that. Oh, definitely. Do preparatory sets for 20 minutes a day, and on every Wednesday work on pullouts. And I'm just wondering, like, what would – and of course, you know, I would never do that. But I'm wondering what somebody would say if they would say, oh, okay. Or would they be like, oh, that's weird that you don't even know the person and you're prescribing a treatment. I don't know.
I think that they would be thrilled.
I think you're right.
I think they would take it and do that exact plan.
I think you're absolutely right. And –
right.
Wow. That's a little scary.
I feel like, I mean, the best advice we might be able to give is to tell them, I mean, the first step of what we would do is just to get to know them and see where they are.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know.
I totally agree. But, you know, I'll say things like, oh, well, you know, listen to your client, explore their stuttering, try to help them figure out what it is about stuttering that's difficult for them, and then to focus on that. And I've actually tried saying things like that, and then I get the question, oh, okay, but then what do? You know, because I think there's this expectation that there is a tool or two tools of choice, and you just, like, plug in the tool. Like, you just plug it in, you put in the flash drive, and that's what you need to do. It like a prescription, like a medication. But I mean, like, I don't know how you guys work, but like when my son gets sick, I'll pick up the phone and call the doctor and say he has 103 fever. What do I do? And I do expect her to have an answer. You put him to bed, you give him a bottle, and if it gets any higher, you go to the emergency room. Or, you know, I would hate for her to say to me, oh, I don't know, or that's hard to say. Or do you guys kind of know what I mean?
But I feel like stuttering is such a more complex thing from that, and everyone sort of has their own issues with it. And it's not one thing that might help someone a lot isn't going to help someone else.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Karen, which is why we love you at Stutter Talk.
Why, thank you.
Bob, we love you too at Stutter Talk. Is there anything you'd like to add before we move on to the next topic?
Well, yeah, I think it'd be more like if you called your son's doctor and said, you know, my son is having nightmares or something like that. Maybe that isn't the best example, but again, then there'd be other questions to follow that up before saying, well, if he's having nightmares, just, you know, put him to bed with a bottle. Maybe the answer wouldn't be quite that simple. It might be like, oh, there might be reasons why, you know, there might be things going on that are leading to the fact that he's having nightmares that are a little bit less concrete than having a fever. And I think that's kind of what we're dealing with stuttering, is that it's not quite as concrete as just, well, if he would talk slower, or if you would have him learn to use easy onsets, he would be fluent. And so I think that's why we need to do a little bit more digging before we give these simple answers to how you should deal with somebody who stutters.
Mm-hmm. Great points. All right, guys, I'm going to throw out a topic, and let's see if we can do an extra brief roundabout on this topic, just like a minute each or so. Last week when I spoke to Dor Breitenfeld, he kept talking about the problems that arise from lucky fluency, when you just have these periods where you're just not stuttering at all, not because you're really working on your stuttering, you're just waking up on, quote, the fluent side of the bed. So, Bob, let's start with you. Is lucky fluency a curse? Is it a good thing? Is it a little bit of both? What do you think?
I would say that it's both, because certainly when you're fluent, it's hard to find things to work on, and certainly when you're fluent, it makes you feel pretty good, pretty happy about things, and so when your speech is good, it's it is sort of a curse. But again, you know, when things are going well, you are less inclined to worry about them. Just like when you have a good job and you're bringing in money, you're less likely to worry about socking money away. And then suddenly when you lose your job, or you get a job that pays less money, you say, gee, I wish I had not been quite so such a spendthrift when I was making more money. That's more of a human nature kind of a thing, I believe. Mm.
You know, I had a friend when I was about 20 years old who had been with the same girlfriend for something like 4 or 5 years. And most of the people I knew at that age, you know, were dating. So he was like my one friend who really was in a committed relationship. And he used to say things to me like, when things are going well with your girlfriend, you work even harder on the relationship so that it continues going well. So he said, you know, when things are going good, you just keep riding it. You keep trying. And I think with lucky fluency, for me, just me personally, it was kind of a curse, and I had to make sure that when I was not stuttering, I had to stutter. Because for me, I spent so many years avoiding stuttering that when the lucky fluency just appeared, I had to make sure to ride that lucky fluency by stuttering on purpose, because I could get sort of sucked into that not stuttering mode, and then all of a sudden I would start avoiding and changing words and not picking up the phone. So for me, it was good because I got to really have to remind myself I'm a stutterer and I need to stutter, so I better turn on some stuttering today. Karen, I went over my minute, so take it where you will.
No, it was actually really good to hear what you had to say. I just experienced some lucky fluency a few weeks back, probably lasted about a week or so, and I was a little bit concerned in that week that I was going to fall back into old ways, and I think it was definitely a curse, and the old me probably would have kicked myself for saying that, because that was like my ideal situation, but I think it made starting to stutter more so much harder. And as I started stuttering because the spontaneous fluency sort of wore off for whatever reason, it made it so much more frustrating. And I know that deep inside I knew it's not like it was gone, but I thought maybe it was going to stay like that. Mm. And it made it really tough again to sort of get so stuck. So I don't think the week of spontaneous fluency was great enough to sort of outweigh the fallout.
Mm. Yeah, I personally relate to that very much. Bob, do you want to have a final word on this?
No, I think that your points are really excellent, right on. Again, it's kind of nice in that moment, but it certainly is not going to give you any long-term benefit if you just sort of let yourself ride that lucky fluency and don't do anything during that time.
No, I'll just really quickly just bring up one last point. That I don't know if this is factually true, but I've always felt that having those lucky fluency periods were ideal times to work on speaking strategies and to work on voluntary stuttering and advertising. Because in my own mind, at least logically, it seemed when you were having lucky fluency, you were less worried about stuttering, less anxious about stuttering, and could therefore focus on intentionally stuttering or using speech tools, at least in theory to me.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, let's take a quick break and come on back and hit our big topic of the day, graduate students who stutter.
This is Natalie Bragan from the State of Maine chapter of the National Stuttering Association, and you're listening to Stutter Talk. To find out more about our chapter, visit www.westutter.org.
This is Dorvin Breidenfeld, the author and developer of the Successful Stuttering Management Program, and I am talking with Peter Reiches on Stutter Talk.
Hi, this is Dan from the Central Wisconsin chapter of the National Stuttering Association. At our monthly meetings, you will meet others who stutter, share experiences, and practice your speaking skills. For more specific information about our group, contact me at 715-536-0079 or visit the NSA website at www.westutter.org. We hope that you can join us at a meeting.
Say some things I shouldn't have said. Should have kept it to myself instead.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk. Peter Reitz is here with Dr. Robert, the expert Queasel. Karen Herring, I guess I will find a new nickname for you, Karen. I was thinking of Dreamy Karen only because at the NSA a couple years ago, I was talking to you, and when we parted ways, a young man came up to me and said, "Is that Karen Herring? She's so dreamy." But
that's pretty funny.
Yeah, young man, 18 or 19. So, but I don't think Dreamy Karen has a ring to it. So I'll think of something.
All right, good.
Stutter Talk can be contacted 206-666-5340, stuttertalk@stuttertalk.com. So our big topic today, guys, is graduate students who stutter and speech and language pathologists who stutter and the challenges we face. And Karen, I want to ask you in just a moment to talk about some of the things you have or are experiencing now in grad school. But I just want to mention that I had a rough day or two last week when a client's having a tough time, I bring it home with me. I feel that pain. And I was working with a student and great parents, but the parents get in bad places too because of their child stuttering. And at one point the mother said to me, "Well, you can't really relate to the pain of my child because, yeah, you've stuttered and, yeah, you've been in bad places, but you've come out the other end of it. You're no longer in that bad place. And it's kind of like, so at one end, somebody might say to you, you really aren't going to be a great speech therapist because you stutter. And on the other end, someone's saying, well, you stutter, but you don't really remember what it feels like to stutter. So I don't know, have you guys ever experienced somebody saying something like that to you, like you stutter, but because you might be handling it productively now, you really can't relate to your clients? Bob, have you ever experienced that?
I think I'm lucky because I've never reached the point where I'm really that skilled at dealing with my own stuttering.
Okay. Wow, that's a heck of a statement, Bob. I think that's half in jest and half in earnest, or
No, really. Yeah. I've never been in a place where I'm in a session with a client, and I'm sitting there being really, really fluent, and they're sitting there going, well, you don't know what it's like to stutter. It's like, let me show you that I know what it's like to stutter. I'll sit here, and I will talk to you for 5 minutes, and you will understand that I know what it's like to stutter. And I think that, and also, you know, just when you talk to clients and you can express to them things like not wanting to do things because you stutter, you know, choosing things in a restaurant because they're easy to say as opposed to the food you want to
right.
eat, those sorts of things. I mean, those are the kinds of things that when you give those examples of people who stutter who have never had therapy, their eyes light up. They're like, wow, you know, you know about that?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, as I say, I don't think I've ever reached a point in my life where I can lord my fluency over any other people. So I don't, and again, you know, I have doomed children to stutter, to a lifetime of stuttering by my powerful model. Remember the letter that I got from our friend. Anyway,
well, just so the listeners know, Bob is joking. That last comment wasn't serious. He hasn't anybody right. said anything. But you know, it's so. I will say that in 10 years of being a speech language pathologist, I can remember right now two moments where this happened to me, where one adult got really upset with me and said, it's harder for me than it was for you. And very recently the mother said, you know, you've come out the other end of it. Karen, have you, I know that your career is just starting, but have you ever experienced anything like that?
I've never experienced it, but I can almost relate to what the clients have said.
Okay.
I've never thought about it for you, but I know it sort of rubs me the wrong way when people say, like, the stuttering role models or celebrities who stutter, and I'm supposed to relate to them, and I don't, because either they spontaneously recovered or they use tools so well that I don't ever hear them stuttering. But someone like that really isn't a role model to me. So I can kind of relate to, like, when they're saying that their speech is so hard to deal with, I almost feel like saying, like, you have no idea. Like, you haven't dealt with this in so long.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, though, because most speech pathologists don't stutter. So it's interesting.
Well, if someone who didn't stutter said that, I would say the same thing.
Yeah, no, of course. Of course. So, and it's weird because I don't like therapy to be about me. But it is weird when it sort of for a moment becomes partially about you. Because I also know that, I mean, there's parents who I think would be upset if you're not handling stuttering, quote, well enough. But... I'm still trying to work through this one.
Well, Peter, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
What would have happened if you had been a fluent person doing therapy with that kid?
Yeah.
I mean, what would mom's issue have been
well,
then?
Well, that's exactly my point, is that most speech pathologists don't stutter. So I one of the things that I remind myself of is that a lot of things we do come from places of joy or from places of pain. And I think the comments that I've just shared with you probably came from a place of pain where and frustration. So I think it's possible that mom was venting just a frustration. Like, you know, I was encouraging the family to participate in self-help. And that's something that I think is very scary to not only people who stutter, but to families. I think it would signify a different level of acceptance. So I just feel that mom was making the point of, well, this is easy for you to say because stuttering's no longer a problem for you. So I don't know if it's entirely logical, but I don't know, Bob, if that's a satisfying answer or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, if it just seems to me like it would be tough. I'm just not sure what she would have said if an SLP who didn't stutter had said something to her, what her comment to that person would have been. Because obviously I guess it would have been, you've never stuttered, so you don't know what we're going through. So, I don't know.
That's a great point. And for some reason, it's bringing me back to what Dorf said on the show last week. And I really respect Dorf for this, where he fundamentally believes and has always said that anything a clinician recommends, the clinician needs to do first. So perhaps I could have done a better job of explaining to the family. And I mean, I thought I did do a good job, but perhaps I could have done an even better job of explaining how not only participating in self-help is a good thing, but I had done it myself, and here's how it helped me get from that bad place. I don't know. I don't know if there is an exact answer to this experience I'm sharing. But it's a different twist on this whole speech pathologist who stutters thing.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you don't really hear that twist very often.
No, you don't, but I have actually heard it enough times, though, because, you know, there's quite a few people in our field who stutter, and some of them don't stutter that noticeably anymore, and it does seem to rub some people the wrong way.
Yeah, it just didn't ever even cross my mind, but it's very, very true. Yeah.
So, Karen, speaking of speech pathologists who stutter, you are soon going to be a speech pathologist who stutter. And recently on Stutter Talk, you had mentioned to Joel and Roisin during a B-Team show that you were having some challenges with a professor. Could you briefly summarize what's going on?
Just a quick editor's note here. Stutter Talk just wants to make it clear that the discussion about to take place concerns an alleged situation, albeit an alleged situation that occurs much too often in speech-language pathology. Now back to the show.
Well, I'm not at school right now, so I don't really have contact with this professor anymore, but I was working with her, or him, I was working with the professor.
Okay.
In a clinical setting, and after we were done, the professor basically confronted me and was sort of saying that I needed to advertise my stuttering before I had. And, I mean, I advertised my stuttering the first time that I actually stuttered, but it wasn't the first thing out of my mouth. I'm going to introduce myself and explain what I was going to do first. And I just happened to be fluent during that time.
So the professor didn't say, oh, you shouldn't have advertised. The professor said, oh, you advertised too late in the session. You should have advertised as soon as you started the session?
Right.
That is just wild. It's just unbelievable that somebody would think they have the right to tell you when you should tell someone else that you stutter.
That's what I felt. Yeah. Like, number one, I think it was my choice altogether if I chose to share.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't think that was, I mean, if I chose, I didn't want to share that, then I don't think she had a right to tell me that I would have to.
Sure.
But she also, I mean, doesn't have the right to tell me when I should.
I completely agree with you 100%. I mean, you chose to share that you stuttered. You don't have to tell someone, oh, by the way, you just heard me stutter and I'm a stutterer. So that strikes me as I don't know what it is. If it's controlling, if it's some pretense of professionalism, I don't know, Bob. What do you think of that?
I think that oftentimes supervisors do strange things, and and I happen to be one sometimes. So but that's one of those things also where it's just sort of hard to understand exactly why somebody would say something like that.
Right.
But I think that you're right that it doesn't make sense. I'm sure there were other things that went on in the session that the supervisor could have commented on that probably would have been more important about whether you chose to advertise at the right moment of the session. It just seems to me to be sort of strange and
right.
You guys are reminding me that I can remember in grad school a supervisor saying to me that you shouldn't, I don't know, I don't think she used the word advertise, but you shouldn't tell clients you stutter because it's not about you, it's about them. And it's just so interesting to me that there's so many hands in this pot. Like, for some reason, speech language pathologists, I mean, I think it's overstepping. And I'm sort of putting my thoughts together as we talk, but have you guys ever been in a conference where a speech pathologist comes up to you and they think they have the right to give you advice on your stuttering?
No, but that's crazy.
Oh, no. When I first started in this field and my stuttering was a lot more pronounced, I would have somebody come up to me and say, oh, you sound really good today. Or, oh, you know, I've been doing this work a long time. I have some techniques I can show you. And you're like, oh, I was just asking you where the bathroom is. You know what I mean? But I mean, I've had this happen to me enough times where
that's crazy.
Seems like there's a little bit of, I mean, would a doctor start prescribing or telling somebody about their health if they're, you know, to a waitress at a restaurant? I mean, so it does seem to me like a major overstepping here.
Well, yeah, and my story goes past
okay.
this. I just don't think this professor was thrilled with me in general. But after I saw this client with the professor, another professor caught this professor sort of gossiping about me in the hallway and saying some not nice things about me and basically saying that people who stutter shouldn't be in this field.
Was there any rationale given for such a statement?
The professor that caught the other professor went up and asked what they were talking about, and the professor that was gossiping refused to say.
Mm, of course.
So,
I
don't really know. Yeah. I mean, Roisin made a point that sort of stuck with me during the B-Team show. That was sort of like maybe she was threatened by me and that I sort of, well, I feel like I know a lot about stuttering, and maybe that she just didn't like that because she's supposed to be sort of the one that's supposed to help me.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to learn from her, and I guess I didn't really need to learn from her in this aspect.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable possibility. Bob, do you want to add anything? I mean, it's just, you taught me something, Bob, about replacing words. So if somebody says, oh, a person who stutters shouldn't be in this field, I mean, if you replace that with, oh, a Jewish person or, oh, an African-American person, it's just blatantly wrong. Bob, maybe you could help everybody understand where this stuff comes from. What are, well, you, okay, I'm trying to get the acronym correct. You are a member of the CAA, which stands for what again, Bob?
The Council on Academic Accreditation.
So what is it about stuttering that programs do look at or should be looking at? Like, when does a program have the reasonable right to concern themselves with the stuttering of a graduate student?
Well, I mean, about the only thing that's in the CA standards, accreditation standards, that would relate to anything that, you know, has to do with, like, speech fluency, there's a sort of an English language, you know, the standard that says, you know, the students are able to, you know, use standard English or something like that. And that's, you know, mainly just a thing to, you know, to ensure that you're turning out students who can actually do speech therapy. You know, you don't want somebody who's not able to, you know, to speak, you know, well, you know, trying to teach other people how to speak. And I think that, you know, you could take that to an extreme and say, well, if you don't have good speech fluency, then you can't be an SLP. But again, there are people in this profession who have voice problems. There are people who have artic problems, you know, and so it's not like you have to be a perfect speaker. There are people who are audiologists who have hearing losses, hearing disorders. And so I think that there's nothing really in the CAA standards that says a student has to be fluent. That's just not there. There's nothing like that. But most programs have some kind of a policy that has to do with the student's ability to speak well, I guess is how you'd put it.
What was so weird for me when I was at New York University is that I had a speech screening and I had to read the famous Rainbow Passage, which has, I believe, all the sounds of the English language in it. And of course, I probably joked at the beginning, well, it's pretty clear that I'm a stutterer. But I mean, how can somebody measure when stuttering is too much, where it gets in the way of effectively communicating? I mean, like what criteria are programs going to use to say, oh, you've crossed a threshold here? Because like when I was at NYU, my impression was any stuttering was too much and would require me to be in therapy for the entire time I was in grad school.
I'm confused about that too. Can like schools still force the students to go to speech therapy?
I hear it.
Or could you have just been like, no, I'm not?
I hear it all the time. It was in my graduate student handbook. So if I would have said, no, I'm not, then I would have been kicking myself out of school, basically.
I wonder if that's still true.
I mean, I get calls all the time about this stuff from graduate students who tell me that they are required to be in speech therapy. Bob, do you want to shed any light on this?
Well, there are certain skills, I think, that an SLP needs to have. I think there are certain things that an SLP needs to be able to do. And I think that certainly most of those things that an SLP needs to be able to do can be done even if a person has a moderate degree of stuttering in their speech. I think, though, I think all of us know some people whose stuttering is really, really severe stuttering, and I think that it's possible that in some cases there are people whose fluency might be, or some people whose stuttering might be so severe that it would be difficult for them to do things like, for example, give a test in the way that the test is meant to be administered, because they would not be able to, for example, give the client the directions correctly, read the items for the test in the proper way, and those sorts of things that are going to affect the validity of the test and those sorts of things. And I think that the issue is at what point does that happen? At what point does a person's stuttering become such an obstacle that the person is not able to carry out the duties of what an SLP would do? But just like that someone stutters in and of itself it does not automatically qualify nor disqualify someone from being an SLP.
But if someone stutters to the degree that they wouldn't be able to administer a test like that, does that give the school like the right to tell them that they can't graduate?
Well, I think that's where things get dicey, because the idea is that again I think for any sort of a problem, the school needs to be able to make reasonable accommodations for that student. You know, just like if a student who was blind wanted to go into a CSD program, I mean, basically the school would have to make some sort of accommodations for that student to make it possible for them to be able to succeed in that program. So I think that's where things get a bit dicey, is that, you know, schools have to then make that call to say, well, we don't believe this student is going to be able to succeed as an SLP, and they have to be able to give reasons why they don't believe that the student can succeed. And that's where these things get really, really messy, because again, you know, what exactly are the skills that are going to be needed for somebody to succeed as an SLP? And as I say, at what point does stuttering become such an obstacle that the person really can't carry out the duties of an SLP?
Yeah, there's so many angles to this. Also, in business schools, it's very common for people who have accents or LISPs who are in business school to be required or strongly urged by their departments to get speech therapy to reduce their accent, which is really interesting. I just want to mention very quickly that while we said a few minutes ago that Bob is a member of the Council of Academic Accreditation, Bob is speaking for himself only. Right, Bob?
Right.
Yeah, that's
right.
Very important. I was just trying to point out that Bob has a lot of experience in this area. You know, when I was at NYU, and I'll just keep saying my stuttering was much more pronounced at the time, and I was clearly challenging NYU on their policy, saying that I had to be stutter-free to go through the program. At one point, I was asked by the dean's office to register it as a disabled student for the possibility of accommodations, and I refused to do so because I didn't.
Why?
Well, I didn't feel I was disabled, and I didn't feel that they had made any case that I was unable to do the job. You know, their case was, well, if you stutter, you won't be able to model correctly to do the job of a speech pathologist, and nobody I had spoken to thought that was true. And Woody Starkweather pointed out at the time that this is a field of evidence-based practice. And there's no evidence that I was unable to perform the duties of a speech pathologist. There was just an opinion that somehow my stuttering would prevent me from modeling some aspect of the job. But there was no evidence for that.
I have never thought of you as a person whose stuttering was rose to the level that it was a hindrance to your ability to do what you needed to do as an SLP. And I think that's the issue, is that if they were going to try to make somebody at NYU a test case, I think they chose the wrong person.
but again, you didn't know me then. Well, actually, you did meet me at one point then, yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, as I say, I think that it's this whole issue of, I think that any sort of a blanket statement, you know, that people who stutter need to be stutter free, people who stutter need to, you know, reach a certain level of fluency, people who stutter should not be SLPs, people who stutter are automatically more qualified to be SLPs. I mean, none of those things are true. I mean, it's got to be a matter of, you know, you look at things on a case by case basis. And again, it's very, very hard, because there are a number of factors that are going to enter into whether somebody is really going to be qualified to be an SLP, and some of those things may be things beyond whether the person is fluent or not. So,
Karen, maybe you want to comment on this, but what really frustrates me about all of this is that a graduate school is such a high stressful time for people, and professors have a lot of power, and graduate students, you know, seem to be overworked, underslept, always worrying about passing. If you don't get a B, you're going to fail. So already the stress level isn't good for stuttering. And then you add on the fact that some of us have people in our programs who are somewhat hostile towards stuttering or insensitive, and it's not really conducive for what they're looking for, which is fluency. Have you ever felt like these programs are almost creating more stuttering in us?
I mean, there's definitely points in the program that I was stuttering more than I would had I not been in school.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The situation I explained was really the only time that I felt sort of picked on.
Okay.
But I also felt like I have a pretty strong personality, and I would have fought whatever people threw at me. But I definitely have heard stories from friends who, I was talking to my one friend, and she was telling me that her grade was being reduced because she was going over the time limit for presentation.
Mm.
And she was like trying to explain to them that she was having to prepare like a 5-minute presentation just to make sure she doesn't go over the 15-minute time limit. And it was impacting the information she had to convey. So I feel, I mean, that wasn't really your question.
No, but that's a great point. Well, no, it is, because when you're under that type of situation, there's a good chance you're just going to stutter more, which is going to make you go
right.
even longer. I mean, Bob, is this one of those cases where getting an accommodation would be reasonable or could be reasonable?
Yeah, and again, I think that's almost a common sense accommodation. In other words, all gets back to the whole idea that, you know, we as a profession, you know, have done ourselves a disservice. If we have people in this profession who allegedly know about stuttering, okay, and they're teaching in universities, and they have kids who stutter or young adults who stutter in their classes, and they're sitting there and they're penalizing them because they can't meet some arbitrary time limit because they stutter. Mm-hmm. It's like, get a clue. I mean, come on. And you sit there and go, you know, this makes me embarrassed for my profession that these things happen. You know, it'd be one thing if it was a disorder that we didn't understand. Okay, the kid comes to class and he or she has some, I don't know, I can't think of a good disorder, but something that we don't deal with as SLPs, which is getting harder and harder to find.
You just made me laugh so hard I hiccuped. That's wild.
But anyway, there's some kid comes to our class and we don't know about their problem, okay? And therefore, we're sitting there and we kind of scratch our heads going, well, I'm not quite sure what the best way to deal with this is, or we set up some kind of a thing and we don't understand that this person's problem makes it unable for them to meet this sort of arbitrary standard that we have set, you know, and so then the student hopefully would clue us in, or the disability support office would fill us in and say, well, no, this is the nature of this disorder, and this is why you shouldn't be treating the student that way, and we'd go, oh, okay, I see, I understand, and then we would make the adjustment. But as SLPs, we shouldn't need to do that for kids who stutter. It's not like, oh my God, I didn't realize that it might take them more time to get out their message. You know, the reason I'm laughing is because if I don't laugh, I will cry.
Yeah.
You know, but this is just, it's sad. It's really sad.
It could be really easy to get upset about that. You know, it's interesting that Dorv said on the show last week, and Dorv is retired. I'm not sure his exact age, but he had said he'd been a speech pathologist for about 50 years or so. And he was saying that when he started in speech pathology, Bring Bringelson, who's a well-known name in the early days of her field, encouraged Dorv not to pursue becoming a speech therapist because he stuttered himself. And Ari, who is a regular listener to Stutter Talk, he sent me a passage from the Fred Murray book. And Fred Murray is a speech pathologist who stutters. And he's been on Stutter Talk. And he wrote that in 1947, when he was entering the field of speech pathology, Wendell Johnson, a stutterer himself, tried to counsel him out of this field because he stuttered, and that it's just so hard for a stutterer to become a speech pathologist. Bob, are you surprised to hear that somebody like a Wendell Johnson or Bring Bringelson would try to counsel a stutterer out of this field? I mean, Wendell Johnson stuttered himself.
Right. I believe that Bringelson did too, but I maybe not. I know that Bringelson was a contemporary of Johnson and Van Riper. Those three guys were essentially the first three doctoral students to come out of the University of Iowa. Studied with Travis back in the early 30s, I believe. But anyway, I'm not sure if Bringelson stuttered or not. I'm trying to recall. But anyway. It's possible that those folks may have seen some of the obstacles that people who stuttered faced, you know, trying to get into the profession. And they were simply trying to say, you know, you're going to face some problems, and so this might not be the best profession to go into, even though it may seem like a good profession. There might be other things that you might want to consider. Because as I say, I think that, you know, just because you're a person who stutters doesn't mean that you're necessarily highly qualified to be an SLP, you know, and I've
met a few of those stutterers, by the way. I've met a few at SLPs who stutter that, let's just say we haven't agreed on everything. Not saying they're unqualified, of course. I am not saying that.
But you know, so as I say, when you hear those sorts of stories, you know, also those stories have been filtered by many, many years as well. And so I'm not saying that either Fred nor Dorf are being dishonest in what they're saying. But I'm also saying that, you know, you have to understand that those statements were told to them in some sort of a context, and that maybe the message that was meant to be imparted by Johnson and Bringelson was not necessarily the message that was heard by those folks. Because, believe me, as somebody who's talked to students for many, many years, I understand that I will say one thing, and then when the student comes back to me a month later and says, well, you said this, it's like, wait a minute, that's not what I said.
Right.
And so, you know, people often sort of mishear things, not on purpose, but you may be talking about something in a larger conversation, and you may mention, well, maybe there might be other things you can do besides be an SLP, and the person hears that as you shouldn't be an SLP, and those are two different messages.
Mm. Well, I think my closing shot on this topic is that I was really pleased when some Stutter Talk listeners wrote in and say, hey, I just want to mention that I'm a speech pathologist who stutters, and my graduate program was wonderful. So
that's great.
It is great. And, you know, unfortunately, that wouldn't make for the best radio, you know. So what was your graduate school like? Oh, it was great.
It was awesome.
I had no problem. So I do want to point out that if you stutter and you want to go into this field, you might be wise to ask around and find a stutter-friendly program. Karen, do you have any parting thoughts on this topic?
No. Nope.
All right. Bob Quisel, Bob the Expert Quisel, any parting thoughts on this topic?
Well, the only thing I will say is that I was shocked when I heard Karen talking on the B Team show, because I would have considered Purdue to be one of those stutter friendly programs. Again, because you figure when you have somebody like Bill Murphy on the faculty, that, you know, he would certainly provide the model of the SLP stutters, who certainly has managed the speech very, very well, and you're not going to find a nicer guy than Bill. Mm. And
yeah.
So when there are people who work with Bill who still have these narrow-minded attitudes about people who stutter, you say, we're in worse shape than I thought as a profession.
Yeah. and I don't want to put words in Bill's mouth, but I think he was a little shocked and hurt to hear that too. That someone that he has worked with for so many years still has these thoughts about people who stutter being in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as the president of Stutter Talk now, I feel like I am obligated to say that all of these comments are alleged. And that I've heard wonderful things about Purdue University and that program from both Karen and Bob and from many other people. And that perhaps, you know, a positive way to look at all this is that in these universities are large, and maybe that even in the best of places, there may be a voice that is not as sensitive as it should be. But I've heard so many great things about your program, Karen, that hopefully this is just an anomaly.
Yes, it really was. I had a great time there, and I learned a lot. And with the exception of this one instance, I felt like everyone was very, very nice and treated me more than fair.
Great. Bob?
And I think also having somebody like Bill that you could go in and talk to certainly helps as well, because...
Oh, of course.
Because you know that there are allies on the faculty if something like that comes up. And I think that the difference probably between Karen's experience and yours, Peter, was that when you were being treated unfairly, you had to go to Temple University, to Woody Starkweather, to find an ally, and Karen had to basically walk down the hall to find somebody.
Yes.
And I think that's the difference between the more stutter friendly and the less stutter friendly program.
Well, you're kind of right, but I just had to walk out of the door of NYU, and just about everybody was an ally. It was sort of amazing how many people joined me in that battle. So, I mean, it was just so blatant, you know, stutter-free policy. But anyway, well, guys, I want to thank you both for joining me today on Stutter Talk. This is Peter Reitzes here with Bob Quisel and Karen Herring. And thank you for your time, and have a good week, guys.